Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 2nd of December. Very nice to have you with us on this snowy Tuesday, and I thank you so much for being with us. I realize that for a lot of you, your schedules are all screwed up. Many of you, your work has been closed, or the kids are home from school, or classes have been canceled, or whatever the case may be. So I don't know whether that means that more people or less people will be listening today. But I've always found that if people are out of their routine, you just never know what's gonna go on. But we're very much in our routine today, and we're gonna have a show, and we have wonderful panelists. Some of them are on the phone because we wanted them, you know, we wanted them safe and sound. And one who is making their debut traveled throughout this town to get here and made it. So we're thrilled to welcome her, and it'll all be fine. And of course, you at home, we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me make our introductions here, and I think we're getting everyone on the line as we speak, but let me begin with our brand new panelist today, who is Asmat Ahmad, and it is a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is the best. I didn't ask you what your title should be for the show, of how you would like to be introduced. What I came up with, and you tell me where I'm wrong here, specialist in government and public service healthcare consulting.
Excellent.
Okay,
I think you nailed it.
Is that pretty much it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you've been doing this for a long time.
I have been working in healthcare technology for a long time. Yes.
What does that mean ultimately for us? We think of healthcare technology as, I mean, it can mean many different things. I mean, it can be for surgery, or it could be for billing. So
yes.
how does this come in?
More on the surgery side, meaning that I have specialized in working with clinical systems, electronic health records, assisting clinicians in the use of those systems, whether it's in surgery, the pharmacy, whether it is in general medicine, both in the hospital space as well as in clinics. And I currently also work for a government client.
Yeah. And the government's role in that is, I assume, can be varied, right?
Correct.
Because it can or cannot be, I guess, even if it's at a regular hospital, it can still have a government connection.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, of course, the government also provides services such as long-term support services through Medicaid programs. Those services are documented, utilize systems where clinical information is compiled. It's utilized by nurses and physicians to assess those individuals and then to appropriately provide them the level of services that they need, whether it is in a facility or whether it is in their home. So I help manage those systems and deliver those systems.
It is a thrill to have you here today, and I thank you very much for sharing with us. And we look forward to going through the topics with you. We welcome J.P. Miller to the program. And J.P., we're working to get Mike on the line, so let's talk for a moment. But JP is the Empire Report, the wonderful news collection service of finding all of the big stories there in one fell swoop. And JP is the person in charge of that. And good morning, sir. How are you?
Joe, I'm great. Thank you very much for having me on today and for accommodating me on the phone here. The governor says, you know, gave a big warning for the whole state, don't travel if you don't need to. So I'm listening to the governor. but excited to participate on the phone today.
Thank you for listening to the governor, and we appreciate that. And we're happy that you're safe. And we also are just happy to have you on the phone. I was telling Asmat before the show, I said this harkens back to the COVID days where we were doing the show by phone every day. And I'm sure by the end of this show, I'll hate it as much as I hated that.
I was thinking the exact same thing, that I haven't been on the phone since COVID, and it's definitely a different feel. And Asmat, I'm really sad not to meet you in person, but I'm excited to meet you in person soon.
Excellent. Mike Spain is on the line. We put the digits in the correct order, and here we are. Former Times Union Associate Editor, longtime member of this panel, and a dear friend. Mike, how are you, sir? Good morning.
I'm great. I'm sitting here in the warmth of my home, looking out at the snow coming down, and having great empathy for all of you at WAMC who drove into work today and are weathering the storm. I really appreciate it, and I'm happy, like JP, I'm happy to be here, and I do have that PTSD about the whole COVID thing when you think about this was just one of the reminders of how life was altered back then. But I'm glad that the snow will be cleared and we'll get past this very quickly.
When no one was in the studio and it was just me, what I realized what's different now that that wasn't the case when you all were on the phone is I find that my eyes rolled more. But now, when I'm in front of you, I don't tend to do that. It's wonderful to have you all here. I want a special shout-out to my wife because she said, do you want me to pack you a bag in case you have to stay over? And I said, no, I don't need a bag. I'll be fine. I'll make it home. Don't worry. And she said, well, you know, it seems safer that way. And I said, no, I'm good. And so I got in the car and I came down, and as I was getting my bag out of the car, I realized that she had put an overnight bag in. So I just want to thank her for that. That was very sweet. I don't know whether I'll need it, but it's nice to know that it's there. Good morning, all. Let's get to the stories at hand, and we would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll start with the boat strike fallout is the headline. I'm going to read a story from the Washington Post that is looking at this. There's a couple back-to-back stories, but we'll start with this one. And a lot about accountability. Officials in Congress and the Pentagon said Monday they are increasingly concerned that the Trump administration intends to scapegoat the military officer who directed U.S. forces to kill two survivors of a targeted strike on suspected drug smugglers in Latin America, as lawmakers made initial moves to investigate whether the attack constituted a war crime. The Washington Post reported Friday that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave a spoken order to kill the entire crew of a vessel thought to be ferrying narcotics in the Caribbean Sea, the first of nearly 20 such strikes directed by the administration since early September. When two survivors were detected, the military commander overseeing the operation, Admiral Frank Bradley, directed another strike to comply with Hegseth's order that no one be left alive. People with direct knowledge of the matter told the Post the Trump administration has said 11 people were killed as a result of the operation. But now that story is changing slightly, and in the sense that there is more to be said with officials now. The word being that Hegseth ordered the lethal attack, but not killing of survivors. So they're making that distinction between the two. In the New York Times, it says the Trump administration defended the legality of a September 2nd attack on a boat in the Caribbean as calls grew in Congress to examine whether a follow-up missile strike that killed survivors amounted to a war crime. The lethal attack was the first in President Trump's legally disputed campaign of killing people suspected of smuggling drugs at sea as if they were combatants in a war. It has started coming under intense bipartisan scrutiny in recent days amid questions about the decision to kill the initial survivors and what orders were issued by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Carolyn Leavitt said that Admiral Bradley had worked well within his authority and the law directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated. For his part, the president said he knew nothing about the second attack on the survivors. Ozma, would you like to begin?
I think one of the first things that struck me about this story, and as we learn more, is the fact that it was a verbal order that was given. And I look back at the areas where I work and how verbal orders continue to be an area where in medicine we try to minimize those as much as possible. It's open to interpretation. What would he have said? Would he have said, "and any survivors," while giving a verbal order? That seems to be, to me, a stretch. It also seems to be a stretch that an admiral, given his position, would not be clear about international law regarding survivors and would have acted on his own if he did not have a direct order to eliminate everybody on that boat.
And especially, I keep hearkening back to, I think it's the second time I've used that word incorrectly. I keep going back to the time when not that long ago, where all of the military brass are brought into a room, and mm-hmm. you say, "Well, okay, this is what we need. You're on our watch. Mm. This is what we need you to do. You got to listen to us. And if you don't, you're out. You're gone." Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It just it seems, Mike, like that may come back to haunt them too.
Well, yes. But one thing to point out, and in one of the Washington Post pieces I read over the weekend, is this could be a war crime, but the Pentagon is the judge and jury, and it's their interpretation that seems to prevail when there are these allegations, and it takes a long time for the process to play out in the civilian courts or in Congress. But at least bipartisan efforts in Congress now are looking into this, and I find that encouraging. And getting back to the whole way this story unfolded, it was only Friday that the Washington Post quoted sources in the Pentagon who say to the Washington Post that they heard Pete Hegseth actually say this. And that's a really good point that you bring up, is that it's verbal, but the commanders all heard it. And so did others who spoke to the Washington Post. And the reporting that's going on is excellent. I find that encouraging, because Pete Hegseth has tried to stop the press from being able to report about the Pentagon, and clearly he has failed in that regard. But in any event, the whole way that this has unfolded and the way the story has changed is, I think, going to be very troubling for Hegseth's status. Trump could come back, but it looks like he's kind of stepping away from it. And it's clear that this Admiral Bradley is being scapegoated. And it's a very sad situation, because, unfortunately, Admiral Bradley has every incentive to go along with that and allow himself to take the fall. Because if he doesn't do it, he could face a court-martial. And if he does do it, he probably will earn himself a very commonly distributed bonus these days, a presidential pardon, and that will protect him and his pension and everything else. So you have a situation where they want to shut this up, and if they need a fall guy, they have a a good incentive to keep the fall guy in line, and we're watching all this unfold.
Right, but just reality check, this isn't how it's supposed to work, right? I mean, that's not how it's supposed to go down.
No. I, as the six Democratic members of Congress pointed out last week, the military's obligation is to support the Constitution and not commit illegal acts. And I think it's becoming blatantly clear that these were exactly that. These were acts that are outside of legality.
Now, I want to wait. We're going to take a break, and then we'll go to JP because I want to hear what he has to say on this. But you bring up a great point, which is we have a real-world example of exactly what those senators were saying in that video of be concerned. These are the things that you have to watch out for, and here we are. And I find that like accidentally on purpose. I mean, it just seems as if it was set up, and here we are walking right into it.
Well, yeah. I mean, perhaps those members of Congress had some intelligence or had
knew
what the Washington Post.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Knew in advance. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to JP and we'll find out what's going on. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about the lethal attack that was ordered by Pete Hegseth. But now officials say that while the Secretary of Defense did order the initial strike, he did not of the second of killing the survivors. That is now being scrutinized by members of both parties, and there is talk of war crimes, and there is much finger-pointing going on as the story continues to grow in the sense of more information being added to the equation. We've heard from two out of the three of our panelists, and we go now to J.P. Miller.
Thank you, Joe. So what I found interesting about this was that Senator Roger Wicker, the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is planning to conduct a congressional investigation into this. And as you see, Trump, from what I've seen in press reports, kind of signaling space between him and Hegseth, and that he might not be as 100% full-throated of a supporter of Hegseth as he was when he started out. I think you could see, Republicans in Congress looking to find out more about this and hopefully bringing to light exactly what happened. And I think you can also see the president, you know, this isn't, as we know, Secretary Hegseth's first issue that he's had. He has had a very tumultuous first now 12 months in office or 11 months in office. And, President Trump creates a lot of his own issues and negative stories in the press. He does not like to see his people create those issues for him. You know, he makes enough unforced errors on his own without his people doing that. And so you may see coming into the new year as the White House reassesses what their plans are for 2026 and beyond, I think you may see Pete Hegseth be the first high-profile cabinet secretary to depart if this issue continues to, percolate, and if there are more issues going forward. And you can see from Hegseth's statements on this is that he has not really denied that he did this. He's had a very careful denial that doesn't really deny that he did it. And there's a question as of whether the strike was ordered on the boat or on the or on the people on the boat. And that's a very important distinction as to how the strike was ordered.
But, and I don't know much about such things, but it would seem to me that if you were not intent on hurting the survivors, then you would not strike again, right?
I don't know. I'm not a military guy. I don't know about wanting to sink the boat versus save the lives of those people. But what I read about this is there is a distinction as to whether it's an attack on the boat or on the or on the people on the boat.
Right. And Mike, I want to go back to something you said too, because I think this is really interesting. But this is also another, I was making the case earlier of you know, these things seem to be, we get real world examples of how certain policies can be problems. And in the sense of the Pentagon, the Department of War / Defense, that Hegseth has basically said, thrown out the press corps. Even his own former network, Fox News, is not a part of that press corps. And so you get a lot of people who are yes folks. And yet this story still gets reported, which says a lot. And I just wanted to go back to what you were saying of how good the reporting has been on this very issue.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's great. We can credit the reporters, and these are veteran reporters who deserve a lot of admiration and credit for bringing these stories to light. But, you know, it's probably an awful lot of people within. And that seems to come out in the New York Times analysis today. An awful lot of people within the Pentagon, certainly outraged at this, outraged that they're throwing Admiral Bradley under the bus. That was one of the quotes that one of the papers, news organizations had of a Pentagon official. And they wouldn't be so vocal to the news media if they weren't so outraged. And then any former leaders, you know, military leaders and people with great stature, many have come out and said this is a clear violation of military standards. It's clearly an entirely illegal. Some have used the term, it amounts to murder. And it clearly indicates a distaste for the way that Hegseth is running the Department of Defense. And that's what it is. And that's what the Washington Post correctly calls it. It would take an act of Congress to change it to the Department of War, although he has a nice sign up saying such. And, you know, there's another aspect of this, as you were describing the incident, the first incident, you know, and more than 80 people have died in these attacks on these ships. It contradicts the whole way that it was regarded as a police action. And the, you know, when the Coast Guard would go out and they'd stop one of these ships, they'd arrest the people, they'd put pressure on them to find out where their source was, what their plan was, and who the others were, and then they could go after those people. Here, we're just destroying everything, including any evidence that these people maybe perhaps were not smuggling cocaine, and maybe they were fishermen, or maybe they were smuggling immigrants. Maybe they were just not breaking any international laws. So by blowing them up, and blowing them out of the water, it solves that problem. You don't have you don't have much evidence to incriminate it.
That's right.
Yes, I think I agree with Mike in terms of there should be more of an understanding of who these people are. And, you know, we spoke earlier about the fact that whether the order was given to destroy the boat or the people, even if it was the latter, We're talking about two people who were now survivors clinging on to some material, some portion of the boat, not fighting or not, at least what we have heard, not firing or danger to the U.S. military. In such a case, it would be a crime to, an international crime, to fire upon them, to hurt them, because at this point, they, as human beings, deserve to be rescued and then delivered to the appropriate authorities. I think we do have, there has been some reporting that in later attacks, there were some individuals that were delivered to some of the authorities. So I do think that even if the attack was on the individuals, going and then attacking two people who were clinging for their lives in the water goes beyond the orders or any orders.
In other cases, to your point, other cases where there were survivors, those survivors were, in many cases, taken in and then released.
Yes.
And which is as dictated by law, which does not seem to be the case here. Let's see. We have some letters. Let me get to, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll get to the letters and talk about those. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll continue our conversation right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 2nd of December. And we are talking about the strike on the twin strikes, I should say, on boats that, and this has been, I think one thing, I will get to the letters, but one thing I just think is important to point out on the boat strike and the fallout, and Mike mentioned this in his numbers, but this has been something, this isn't a one-off. This is also, we don't even know about other cases where everyone on the boats have been killed, and that this whole issue has been roiling as a controversy for a while. So that also adds to the context of a story that does get complicated, as is saying that word. All right, let's go to letters. We go to Russ. Most concerning to me are Leavitt's pronouncements on the boat bombings. These were undertaking to defend the country from terrorists, according to her characterization. Never mind that these small boats were unlikely to have the range to reach the U.S., and the same logic would justify the execution of all the mules apprehended at the Mexican border. This is entirely the result of Trump's demand for results, by which he means countable cadavers. That from Russ. We check in with Steve. Hegseth to Admiral Bradley, how dare you follow my illegal order? That's a little setup there, a little role play, writing, a script, if you will. Linda says, can you please talk about the two captured prisoners that Trump sent back a few months ago after their boats were bombed rather than bringing them here for trial? That was what you were talking about, husband. Mm-hmm. I am as dumbfounded by that as I am by Trump releasing the convicted drug kingpin / president. There will be hearings for this recent incident. I hope that somebody will discuss the released prisoners and why that happened. Is it because they would talk and Trump might not like what they have to say? I guess that is a possibility.
Very, very much.
Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to know more about that, too. I think, was it Columbia, Joe, that they were returned to?
And yes,
it was,
I believe so.
At the time, I remember they were described as possibly being fishermen, which would suggest that perhaps their fishing boat was mistaken for a drug transport boat, and that they were accidentally fired upon, and they did survive, and that's a good thing. In that case, somebody had to fish them out of the water in order to rescue them. But I mean, if we're only focusing on the very first of the these efforts by the Pentagon to blow up ships that they say are carrying drugs from, well, presumably Venezuela to the United States, it's a you know, what about the hard look that could happen at the dozens of other operations? It doesn't seem like it's going to stand up to scrutiny. And I kind of agree with JP. You know, you make a good point. Hegseth has had so many run-ins. You know, we had the crazy call where he included a news reporter on a chat group that talked about plans to bomb Somalia. And he had the whole run-in with, you know, his staff over, you know, calling them all from around the world and then kind of yelling at them and calling them out and telling them they got to shave their beards and they got to, and then, you know, his homophobia and his transphobia as demonstrated by his changes in policy for, you know, loyal members of the armed services that are being singled out and kicked out. You know, I think he can start counting his days at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
You would hope that.
Is that what we want to think?
Yeah, right. I mean, I in normal circumstances, whatever that is, however long ago we lost normalcy, I've lost track. But yes, that would, but I think we all collectively said as much during the Signal controversy. I mean, you put a reporter into a group chat that includes most of your family about orders that are military orders on a military strike. You would think that if that doesn't do it, maybe if the pressure does, I agree with JP. However, the one thing here is that Trump is very much distancing himself from it, mm-hmm. And the video from him on Air Force One yesterday of saying I know nothing about that, I have no idea about that. I mean, I'll believe Pete, but I know nothing about that, and turned around and walked back into the his section of the plane. So that's interesting.
I also think that Senator Kelly's comment about not obeying illegal orders has added some weight to the discussion. The military is a value-based organization, and here we have an individual with Hegseth leading by his person. And clearly, in such an organization where you're going against the values of human rights and violating them, there are going to be individuals who are going to raise that question. And I think that Senator Kelly was right to do so. But it does shake up everybody. And I think Trump is paying attention to that as well.
Yeah, I agree with you on that completely. Kelly said it has really stepped up his own attacks on Hegseth, who he calls unqualified for the job. And he's ridiculed Hegseth, saying he runs around on a stage talking about lethality and warrior ethos and killing people. But, you know, this was on Meet the Press on Sunday. Kelly is a tough guy to attack the way they've attacked him. They've talked about bringing him into active service. Hegseth has suggested bringing him back into active service and then court-martialing Kelly for his remarks that you mentioned.
Yes.
I think publicly, if Kelly goes up against Hegseth, a veteran who then went to outer space and has endured the tragedy of his wife, Gabby Gidford, being attacked, as a sitting Congress member, you know, I think the public may be a lot more sympathetic to Mark Kelly than they do this, you know, Pete Hegseth.
Sorry. We are getting so many letters about this, and they're all asking the same thing, which is not a bad point. But what they're asking is, if Trump is so concerned about drug trafficking, this one, as an example from E, says, why did he pardon Juan Orlando from Honduras? And I think that becomes a big part of the story, too. Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, has been released from a U.S. prison, according to online records of federal inmates. He was released from a high-security facility in West Virginia yesterday. He was found guilty in March 2024 of conspiring to import cocaine to the U.S. and of possessing machine guns. He was sentenced to 45 years in prison. The president said Hernandez had been treated very harshly and unfairly in a social media post announcing the move on Friday. This plays into it, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. I do think that what we haven't talked about, we've talked about it lightly, is the purpose of this entire operation.
Right.
We've talked about this one incident, but does everyone truly believe that, first of all, using the U.S. military for these targeted strikes, for these police actions, is the right thing to do? Is it an effective means of accomplishing the destruction of drug pathways into the United States? I know we spoke about the numbers and the number of people who have died, but if we know anything about drug cartels or how they operate in a somewhat lawless manner, I'm not sure that that is a number that they cannot absorb, so to speak. Their networks are vast. These are organizations that are constantly battling the law. So in terms of the whole operation itself and whether it's effective and who signed off on it and who has insight into it, I think that truly should be the greater question. And then the activities that are happening in support of that.
Right. JP.
I do salute the effort to want to, you know, cut off the supply of drugs into the United States. You know, drugs are a huge problem in the country. But the way that they are doing it with the military is obviously sloppy, and more than sloppy, having, you know, sentencing 80 people or more basically to death by killing them without having a ton of evidence to show people of, you know, that they had drugs on the boat or that they're drug dealers. I hope that this operation that they have is going to is nearing an end, and that they can find another way of stopping these boats and properly searching them and prosecuting, you know, the drug dealers. But the recent pardon coming right in the middle of this scandal is ridiculous. In that you know, this was a huge drug kingpin, and they're saying this is so important, this operation, that we're going to call in our military to stop these drug dealers. And meanwhile, someone who was actually prosecuted and sentenced through the, you know, through the appropriate manners, we're going to give them a blanket pardon. It's ridiculous.
Go ahead, Mike.
No, I agree with you. It's just unbelievable that the former president of Honduras, Hernandez, who has been convicted and has been, even in the first Trump administration, this whole process was underway to get Hernandez and to make him accountable for the enormous amounts of drugs that he facilitated in bringing into the United States. I mean, it just makes... It coming right now makes no sense at all. It's scary.
Matthew writes to us and says, please stop splitting hairs. This bombing boats is murder on the high seas. These are suspected, not convicted persons. These are civilian criminals at worst, not combatants. By our own and international standards, the whole program is criminal murder. The release of the ex-Honduran president and the fact that Venezuela does not import much fentanyl shows this is not about saving Americans from the consequences of their own drug use, but is just an attempt to prove Trump can do anything and use terror to control the world. If you feel you can justify this by the excuse you were bombing boats full of drugs, not people, you at least must be prepared to rescue survivors, not shoot them. That from Matthew. That seems like a good place to hold. Yes, go ahead, JP.
No, that makes a good point. And, yeah. You know, logical progression of this, Joe, if we're going to be bombing boats that we think or we contend are bringing drugs into the U.S., what are they going to start doing as people try to cross the border, along Mexico? Are they going to assume that they are carrying fentanyl and just start shooting them without any trial? I mean, this sort of clears the way for that behavior. It's extraordinarily frightening.
It is indeed. It is indeed. We will get back and continue with more stories, and we welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will do all of that after this short news break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. I just want to remind you that today is Giving Tuesday, and it is a great reminder that the most essential things in our lives are worth protecting. WAMC is a unique, trusted news service here for you every day, providing unbiased local information on issues that affect your home, affect you and your family. But we're facing a challenge that we haven't faced in previous years, which I think most of you know about, which is that federal funding for public media has been eliminated, gone. Listener support is now the only way this works, and your gift today will solidify our foundation for tomorrow. We're asking you to recognize that WAMC is funded by listeners. Your donation will be welcomed. It will secure the future of in-depth local accountability for our community. We're asking you to make a difference by giving a gift today. Any amount, whatever you know better than anyone else, what you can afford and what you can't. So if you can do something, that would be great. You can also choose to be a sustaining member or a monthly gift. To do all of this, all you have to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org. You're always there for us. We love you. We thank you so much. You're such a vital part of our community, and we thank you for all your past support, all your future support on this Giving Tuesday. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We will certainly, all you have to do is go to that website, and you can find out any information that you need. All right, we come back to our discussion on the panel this morning. We have a great group. Asmat Ahmed is with us, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We go to other stories and look at the crackdown in the wake of the shooting that took place on the day before Thanksgiving, that new measures represent some of the most significant changes to immigration policy since President Trump returned to the White House. The sweeping crackdown that Trump declared last week, this from the New York Times, after an Afghan national was accused of shooting two National Guard members, is poised to radically curtail immigrants from legally entering and living in the United States, putting up roadblocks unparalleled in recent history. Within a matter of days, the administration rolled out a series of far-reaching policy changes, pausing all asylum decisions for migrants currently in the United States, reviewing the green cards that allow people from 19 countries, mostly from the Middle East or Africa, to live and work permanently in the United States of America. And it is it also is reassessing the asylum approvals issued during the Biden administration, indefinitely halting immigration applications filed by Afghan nationals and barring Afghans from entering the country. The new rules are poised to potentially upend the status of as many as 1.5 million migrants with pending asylum cases in the country. The more than 50,000 who gained asylum from the Department of Homeland Security under the Biden administration, and untold any more who had been hoping to seek refuge in the United States. Oh, and for what it's worth, Mr. Trump has hinted that further action could come as a result of the attack, floating the possibility of denaturalization or stripping people of citizenship. And again, that from the New York Times. Asmat.
A very, very sad event. First of all, the loss of life of the two National Guardsmen, the shooting of them.
Yes, one passed, one still clinging to life.
Yeah. Thank you for correcting me there, Joe. I think many of the statements that have come from the Trump administration, they are not dissimilar to what has been spoken before in the first administration. And so that was an initial reaction. And then as we learned more about the shooter and about the status of many of these immigrants from the countries that were mentioned, one of the things that was spoken about was the greater scrutiny that's required on the paperwork or on the qualification of these individuals. And I think perhaps people are, or it's not spoken about, maybe it is understood, but it always strikes me that many, many of these countries, if not all, do not have in place, due to war or a lack of governance at the right levels, they don't necessarily have the information. So it's not like people have ID cards that they have somehow faked. It is difficult to be able to produce documents and to be able to appropriately assess individuals the way that one would do in a country like the United States, where such records are more readily available, more available for scrutiny. So I do think that there is that aspect of it, and which is a much greater challenge in terms of trying to assess the asylum applications. But then on the other hand, I think as an immigrant myself, these individuals who are seeking safety and asylum in the United States are giving up so much to move to this country. And we also need to look at what are the ways in which they are supported once they are here. This individual or others who are troubled, where are the services, where are the ways that we can identify that there is someone who is challenged by mental health and get them to a place where they do receive those kinds of services, that kind of support, so they are not a danger to themselves? Because I think some of the reporting that I've read states that this individual stayed in a darkened room for days, the family did not speak or communicate to the family, used to go on long drives and disappear for days. All of these were signs that this person was in trouble. What is available to us in a community to see these signs, whoever an individual is, and be able to support them in the way that they need to be either provided medical help or community help? And particularly for an individual who had a family, was not successful in getting a job, what does that do to their psyche after they had come from a country where that was their primary role. So I think it raises a lot of those questions, and quite simply shutting down immigration from a number of countries, I think 19 were named and perhaps more, are coming. I'm not sure that that is a solution to the problem that we are trying to address.
No, and you wonder, I mean, it seems to be a tragedy of convenience in the sense of a horrible thing that happened and then becomes an excuse to do what has been on the radar, it seems, for quite a while. J.P. Miller.
Yeah, I agree with what Asmat shared. You know, we have illegal immigration, as far as we're aware, has really significantly been reduced since Trump took office. And what part of what we want to have is increased legal immigration. And to use this tragedy to slow down legal immigration into the country is a really sad development. We know that native-born Americans can be radicalized and commit heinous acts. We know that, you know, there were thousands of people that were let in under the same program as this individual are living as part of our society, are on their way to becoming Americans, to kind of use this as a political cudgel to blame this on immigrants is really bad. And I would love to end this with my statement with a, but here's what we have to look forward to. But I really don't have that. You know, what is going to be the president's motivation to lift these, restrictions that he's put on? I'm bummed about it.
Indeed. Mike Spain.
Yeah, Joe, I think you're right. I think this was an excuse. This terrible tragedy was an excuse to put into place a plan that was already to limit immigration from what, using the term from third world countries. You know, I mean, that is sort of such a dated reference to nations around the world. And, it's to say it in a pejorative tone, that because this one, and Asmat, you're so correct. I mean, everything we're finding out about this this gentleman from Afghanistan shows that he was in deep trouble. He was very mentally troubled, and it wasn't. There's from everybody who's done good reporting on this, there's not indications that he became radicalized after he got here. It was more that he had severe mental health issues, and it played out in a tragic way, and it's terrible. And I'm not making any excuses, but I'm saying this was not by any means, and certainly according to everything that has come out, it's not a case of somebody who was planted here or came here with an intention to do harm. And his record serving the U.S. military in Afghanistan was stellar. It's just a terrible, terrible tragedy. And as you described it, Joe, a convenient excuse to implement a plan that is draconian. And you're right, JP. We what's going to change? I mean, how will the Trump administration go back on this? It's going to take another presidency to walk back these. It's going to be very difficult. And a lot of people from countries that are absolutely in shambles that need, places where they can be find asylum. We're no longer part of that world, worldly community. We're not offering any help unless you're from South Africa, you're an Afrikaner from South Africa, then we recognize that you can come here as a, seek asylum, and that's the only one. And that just tells it all.
Certainly does. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So before the roundtable came on, writes John, I was listening to the podcast of yesterday's episode of the Canadian program As It Happens. They interviewed someone who knows Afghans who were part of the same unit as the shooter. As one of your panelists pointed out, the U.S. government basically broke every last one of its promises to this guy, pushing him into a mental breakdown. So what is the Trump administration doing in reaction, breaking all of its promises to the Afghans who worked with the U.S.? Typical, Trump and his ilk are putting out a fire they started by pouring on gasoline. That from John. Then we go to Cheryl, who says the blame for the shooting of those two National Guards persons belongs squarely on Trump's shoulders. Had they not been deployed by Trump under the pretext of crime in D.C., they would not have been shot. We go to Scott. Why is no one talking about how the alleged shooter acquired an assault rifle? Was he, to use Trump's medical terminology, cuckoo when he got the gun? Who sold or gave it to him? Did Trump's approval of his asylum application include a permit to possess a gun? If he did not have a gun, we would not be having this conversation. That is from Scott. Then we go to Frank, who says, let us speak truth here. Just because the shooter was of Afghan descent, Trump wants to encourage prejudice against all people from Afghanistan. According to his thinking, perhaps we should now remove all people of Italian descent because of Luigi Mangione. Trump and MAGA Republicans practice the politics of prejudice, and it's wrong, it's prejudice, it's racist, and yes, indeed, wrong. All right. Let's. Anybody else on this? Okay.
No, I just may I say one thing.
Of course.
After wars, when the U.S. has been involved in a foreign conflict and they've been assisted by people in those countries, there's been a flood of people from those various countries, and the one that comes to mind certainly is Vietnam. Terrible war. And so many people in Vietnam left and came to the United States, and they were welcomed in many, many places, and they have become the fabric of our community. They've assimilated. They've brought culture and enrichment to our country. And Afghanis have been coming to the U.S. actually since the CIA was sort of running the shadow war in the 1980s. When Russia was, the USSR had invaded Afghanistan, and the CIA was running a shadow war, kind of helping Afghanis. And after that all ended, some of them came to the U.S. and they have assimilated beautifully into our community. It's the way it works, to take this terrible, terrible attack and use it to foster incrimination against all Afghanis who are here in the U.S. is so hurtful and such a step backwards from what we have been as a country.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So this from the BBC. As we move on, and we have about 5 minutes before a break, and we can continue the story on the other side of the break if we need to. And as soon as the story loads, I'll be ready to go. But it's not loading. Yay! All right, hold on one second. I want to talk about... I want to talk about Gaza and the deaths happening and the number, the high number, and JP, you know that little pinwheel that just goes around and around and around?
I do.
Yeah.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
When you can't stop it.
Yeah. Especially bad during a live radio show, I've found. There we go. Thank you, JP. You solved the problem. More than 70,000 Palestinians have been killed as a result of Israel's military campaign in Gaza, according to the territory's Hamas-run health ministry. The death toll has continued to rise since the ceasefire took effect on the 10th of October, with Israel carrying out strikes for what it says are violations of the truce, while bodies continue to be recovered from under the rubble. Among those reportedly killed in an Israeli drone strike on Sunday were two young brothers whose families say they had been gathering firewood when they were killed. The Israel Defense Forces told the BBC they had struck two suspects who had crossed the so-called yellow line. The line marks where the Israeli military agreed to withdraw to under a ceasefire brokered by the United States more than 7 weeks ago. The boys who died have been described in media reports as an 8-year-old and his brother aged 10 or 11. Figures from the Gaza Ministry of Health have been widely used throughout the war and are seen as reliable by the United Nations and international institutions, but Israel has consistently disputed data published by Gaza's authorities. Asmat.
So much has happened since the truce was declared. However, it was a paused war and a long way to go in the 20-point plan that was agreed upon to get to peace. Now, whether that is sustainable peace is something different. In terms of this particular incident and these two boys, reporting, unfortunately, as we've seen all across these days, has been in this way disbalanced. On the one hand, we know that these two boys were killed. That has been reported. On the other hand, we have reports from the Israeli media that two individuals were killed.
Right.
Not even giving the recognition of the children themselves. I think that is the great tragedy of what is happening in the region is just the basic lack of recognition of the humanity of the other. And there is certainly a lot to be done, and that this is why wars and conflicts of this nature are so bad, because once started, it becomes increasingly difficult, and it has been difficult, to justify one or the other action or the other action, but that is what has continued to happen. We talk about it as a ceasefire, but I don't think that there have been many days, if any day, where someone has not been killed since then. So this is something that we need a lot more efforts by all of the parties that agreed to the ceasefire to establish the institutions in an area which has been completely wiped out. We've all seen photographs of what Gaza looks like right now. To build civil society, to rebuild schools, to rebuild just operations of a community of people, it is going to take a lot of effort. And I think that urgency continues to increase and must be put in place with every opportunity that any of us have.
The idea that it has been 7 weeks since the ceasefire, we still can't look at that in a way of if it's been a success or not, or to judge it in any meaningful way.
That's right.
And if anything, it becomes a moving, I don't want to use the word target, but you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean,
yes.
of that of something that's changing constantly.
Correct. And is it just a diminishing of the violence, or is it a true ceasefire?
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll hear from Mike and JP right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. Right before the break, we were talking about this story, began to talk about the story. This one from the BBC, more than 70,000 killed in Gaza since Israel offensive began. That according to the Hamas-run health ministry. We heard from Azmat and took a break, come back and hear from Mike Spain.
Summed it up, making so many excellent points, particularly the lack of any recognition of humanity that makes this even more tragic and sadder. Whatever the numbers are, if you were going to say that Hamas, if somebody suggests that Hamas has exaggerated the number of people who were killed in this horrible war, it might be plausible to expect that, but it was many, 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 many thousands, probably close to what they're coming up with today. These are people who died in all kinds of ways, who died when buildings collapsed, but died from starvation and illness and et cetera. The powers that control the situation need to rebuild the infrastructure. I agree. It needs to be restored to having some semblance of a functioning society. And then I think it's noteworthy that the calls for a long-term plan that leads to a two-state solution are continuing to come. The latest came just in the last couple days from Pope Leo, who was in the Mideast, who was in Lebanon, calling for peace and urging leaders to promote peace. And I think the world needs, the powers that have the resources need to come together and really guide this process so that it can actually become a true truce, which it is not, Azmat. You said that correctly. It has not been a truce. It's been a substantial reduction in killing, which is good, but it needs to be much more, and it needs the attention of other leaders of the world.
JP.
Great job, both Azmat and Mike. Israel's objective when they agreed to the ceasefire was to get the hostages back, and they got the hostages back. And when that happened, everybody that saw the agreement saw very obvious holes in how things would move going forward. One is they called for Hamas to disarm. Well, Hamas is never going to disarm. They also called for an international police force to be made up of undetermined people from undetermined countries, and that's not coming together. And to do the rebuilding, Mike, that you talk about, that's obviously needed, there needs to be comfort and confidence that when you rebuild these neighborhoods, that they're not just going to get blown to smithereens by Israel, and that Hamas is not going to attack Israel again. So it's a very tough situation. I do not see investment going into starting to rebuild the devastated areas until the fighting stops. And it seems to me like they're calling it a ceasefire, but the fighting has continued, maybe at a reduced rate, but continues nonetheless. And there's always the risk and the specter of increased violence rather than decreased violence. And if you are betting on whether there's going to be, if a year from now, whether that area is a more peaceful place or a more violent place, I would think that people that bet that it's a more violent place would not have would not be making a horrible bet.
And when we, as we look at this, of you think of, or at least I was thinking of this last night, of the plans that have been put in place here, and this truce, and how that goes forward, and then what's being worked on in Russia and Ukraine, and everything is so fragile, and yet we don't seem to have a way to deal with that fragility in any meaningful way to even with the United States sort of leading the charge, and at the same time having many of its longest running allies sort of saying, I don't know, which seems difficult, yeah, to then move to move forward.
Well, you're talking, Joe, certainly of a shift in the role of the United States in international affairs. Give credit where credit is due. It was the United States, the Trump administration, that did pressure Netanyahu and Israel to this point. It doesn't resolve the situation. It doesn't solve it. And a lot more has to happen. JP, you're so right. There's so many unanswered questions about the peace plan that was sort of thrown together, and we'll get to that part when we get to that part. And now we're at that part, and there's not a plan. But, you know, and what's going on? I mean, that could be a whole nother long discussion about what's going on with our pressure to come up with a solution in Ukraine, where, you know, again, I don't want to open Pandora's box, but we've shifted our role significantly there too, and it has not worked well for Ukraine, a longtime ally that we've supported.
Right. That's about.
Yes, I was just thinking of even the basics for the people of Gaza. Food, shelter. Mm. You know, I think that I agree with both of you that there are such tremendous challenges ahead in rebuilding and in even setting aside laws or understanding governance in the forms that are being envisioned. But all of that aside, there are human beings there. There are families, children. That need to be fed, that need to be clothed, that need housing. Is that a place to start? Do we just start there and have efforts across the international community to ensure that that takes place? Because I'm not sure that we're even there yet.
Right. Anybody else?
It's just painfully true. The first thing is to take care of the people. And I mean, rebuilding infrastructure isn't going to happen overnight. And people are starving without breakfast tomorrow. And they need to have that and health care and some security that they are not going to, be bombed or otherwise be moved off where they are. There is not a good plan in place to do any of that.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Two quick things, and we'll wrap up for this Tuesday, this snowy Tuesday. It took a while, but we finally know something about the MRI that the president had in recent weeks that fueled questions about his health. So the White House on Monday said that the advanced imaging scan that President Donald Trump underwent in recent weeks, that had fueled those questions about his health found nothing abnormal, characterizing the check of the 79-year-old's cardiovascular system and abdominal area as a routine procedure. Sean Barbabella, a Navy captain and the president's physician, wrote in a memo released by the White House that Trump's results were perfectly normal, saying that the MRI administered to the president was standard for an executive physical at President Trump's age. The announcement came weeks after Trump on October 10th visited Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for what the White House characterized as a scheduled follow-up evaluation, prompting questions from journalists and some outside physicians who asked why the president was making his second known visit to Walter Reed in just 6 months. Trump, the oldest person to be sworn in as president, has faced scrutiny after observers in the media noticed his visibly swollen legs and a recurring bruise on his left hand earlier this year. The White House in July said that Trump had chronic venous insufficiency, a mild but chronic illness related to his age, a rare admission of any presidential health issue. You can at least keep it to a bruise. So it seems to me, JP, that the big question here of why this is even a story is, why did it take them 7 weeks to tell us that it was nothing but procedure and that nothing was wrong?
It's a great question. I have no idea why it would take 7 weeks to do that. And it certainly seems like they're hiding something, but would they, what is legally required for disclosure? And, I don't know. Do we believe what came out or not? I haven't followed this story as closely as I could. When I see a headline about president and MRI, I don't, it's not my, not my thing.
Well.
Well, there's some of us who live by those MRI results, not just the president, but our own, for goodness sakes. Mike?
So, some commentators have said that the memo from Sean Barbabella, the president's physician, have been conspicuously absent from those memos or any reference to the president's brain. He's been kind of kooky lately. I don't know if you've noticed, his Thanksgiving message was, sort of a mix of diatribes and attacks on people like Tim Walz, for some reason, the former vice presidential nominee from the Democrats. And, it's just odd. He is the oldest person ever elected president of the United States, which means at the end of his 4-year term, he will have become the oldest person ever to be in the White House. That's concerning. And we are all kind of suspicious and maybe skeptical because we know we didn't get the full picture coming out of the White House under the last administration. And, a lot has come out since then. But so I don't think, Donald Trump doesn't have a exclusive franchise on not being forthcoming and honest about health issues when it comes to him. Other presidents have also, going back to FDR, who 3 months before he died was inaugurated to his fourth term with his physician saying he's fully fit for the job. So, I don't know that we're getting the full story, Joe.
Yeah.
It's the grand tradition of not telling us. That he keeps.
Right, it's a tradition.
It's a tradition. That's right. It's the what I'm thankful for, that you all seem to believe this. It's interesting. I just thought I was sucked in. I'll say I was in the House, and David Muir came on. And he said, "When we come back, We'll tell you the results of the president's MRI. And, man, I stopped what I was doing. I sat down. I stayed there. And I said, okay, I know no more than I did when I sat down. But it is interesting. I thought they'd come up with something, but apparently not. We are out of time, my friends. I thank you very much for being with us. And it is such a thrill to have you all here. Asmat Ahmad, thank you so much. A delight to have you here in the studio. A delight to have you on the program. I hope you'll come back and join us. I look forward to that. And we'll have more people in the studio next time, I bet.
No more snow.
No more snow. Yes. And to Mike and JP, thank you for staying safe and for being on the show. And I appreciate your being a part of our shenanigans this morning. Thank you very much. We will continue our discussion on the roundtable right after this.